Senate Bill 5540, which relates to the financial administration of the public defender. Robin?
Mr. Chair and members, you will have in front of you the public defender, and they will be giving you an overview. I wanted to touch on a few points before they do. First of all, just like the Judicial Department budget, this budget comes to you with a 2.4% reduction to the current service level. As a result, the public defender is going to need to reduce 1.3 clerical support positions, and the governor's budget contains no funding to address issues deferred by the 1999 legislature, including salary parity with the Department of Justice attorneys and funding to address the case backlog. As you can tell from the handout that I have given you, the public defenders had difficulty meeting its workload. They came to the emergency board for a supplemental appropriation in October 1999, and as a result of that meeting, the public defender was directed to improve its overall management and to obtain the services of a management consultant, and that consultant will be reporting to you on the outcome of that effort. The public defender is having difficulty meeting its workload and has a chronic appeals backlog. This has been exacerbated by an action taken by the Court of Appeals, which reduces by 100 days the age at which cases where the Court of Appeals will order that no further extension will be allowed on cases, and they'll be talking about that. It goes by the acronym of NFE, so you'll probably be hearing quite a bit of that. The public defender received a cumulative $176,400 from the emergency board to address workload issues. At the November 2000 meeting, the public defender reported on a 42% reduction in their NFE caseload. And at that time, they were projecting that the 85 remaining NFE caseload would be eliminated by the end of the biennium. The public defender will discuss their workload status with you. And the public defender and the Indigent Defense Services Division of the Department of Justice, Judicial Department, have been working together to come up with some mechanisms to deal with the workload within existing resources, and they will talk to you about that also. And with that, I will turn this over to the public defender.
All right. Mr. Groom and Mr. Cannon, welcome.
Thank you.
Identify yourselves for our record and proceed with your testimony.
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Groom. I'm Director of the State Public Defender's Office. With me at the table at present time is Mr. Robert Cannon, who is a member of the State Public Defender Oversight Committee. What we propose to do is I'll first of all give you a brief overview of our operation, and then Mr. Cannon will explain the operation of the State Public Defender Committee, and then we'll move on from there. The State Public Defender's Office was set up in the late 1960s to handle and has come to handle all criminal appeals for the 36 counties. This goes from shoplifting all the way through the death penalty. Our office structure, we have 39 employees. Myself as the director, we have two chief deputies. One chief deputy is the person who oversees operations. That person is Jess Barton. He's here today. The other chief deputy is the one who oversees legal issues and training of personnel. He's Pete Gartland, and I don't believe he's here. Our office manager is Angelique Bowers, and she's present today, and we'll be running our little, I want to call it a slideshow, but I think that's old language. It's a PowerPoint demonstration. We have five senior deputies, three death penalty deputies who do nothing but death penalty appeals. We have two senior deputies who handle our most complex felony cases. Then we have 12 felony deputies who handle the rest of the felony caseload. We have six mixed caseload deputies. That's basically our entry-level position, and these are people that start with misdemeanors and parole. We have some parole appeal cases, and that's where the training starts. We have 11 support staff, most of whom fall within the Office Specialist 2 category. Those folks do a variety of duties, which make, I think, their their job somewhat unique within the state system. They do word processing, they do case tracking, they do management of caseloads for attorneys that have upwards of 130 open cases at any one time. Each secretary has three attorneys to work with, making their responsibility approximately 400 cases for purposes of tracking. And then they also they perform some paralegal duties in the form of drafting of motions when the attorney is too busy to get to that. The cases that we take into our office are divided into two categories when they come in. This is sort of informally, but it's something that's grown up in our office. We call them presumptive merit cases and presumptive Balfour cases. I am told that Judge Landau appeared in front of this subcommittee a couple of weeks ago and talked about Balfour and how that works and what it means, and I'll try not to duplicate that. Presumptive merit cases are cases that arise from appeals from jury trials, before the court trials, and stipulated facts trials, in which we presume coming into the office there's going to be an issue that we are going to actually brief and raise in the Court of Appeals. The presumptive Balfour cases are cases that arise from guilty plea, no contest, and probation violations. We presume that these cases are not going to have an issue and that they're going to go the route of Balfour. And our demonstration will kind of take you through that briefly in a little bit. What I'd like to do now is introduce Mr. Cannon to talk about the State Public Defender Committee. Bob was a deputy public defender in our office much earlier in his career, and was also one of my mentors when I started as a law clerk many years ago, many too many that for me to actually talk about. Bob has also worked as an attorney general. He's worked in private practice. He was longtime county counsel for Marion County and is now a part-time pro tem judge. We're very grateful to have him here. Our chair is Sean McCrae. She's the chair of the committee, but she is coming back from Ireland today and couldn't be here. I'll turn it over to Bob, who's standing in for her.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hanson, Representative Smith, Senator Trove, good morning. my voice isn't going to last very much longer, so I'm going to be real brief. I was a law clerk 30 years ago in the State Public Defender's Office. At that time, we had three attorneys. Public defender was Gary Babcock, Marv Kuhn, and I can't remember the other, Hadley, I guess his name was. Since then, the office has grown considerably. One of the things that I want to emphasize to you today is the public defender system at the public defender level, at the appellate level. We have no control over what goes on at the trial level. We're not the dog that has a tail, we're the tail of the dog. And so whatever happens in that system is going to affect the public defender's office. These folks are hardworking. They spend a lot of time. They're there to support a constitutional system that we all support and that we've sworn to support. Yes, many of the clients in the public defender system have committed ultra-violent acts, unspeakable crimes, and sometimes you don't like your clients. And I've been there. I understand it. You still go through the process of making sure that our system works. So I'm very supportive of the public defender system as a whole. I want to emphasize a little bit the no control issue, because I think that's very important. When I started out of law school in 1972, down in Marion County Circuit Court, if you were appointed on a habeas corpus case, you got no money. If you were appointed to represent a person who was charged with a felony and the person pled guilty, you got $35. If you were unfortunate enough to be appointed for a criminal defendant on a felony case where they had to go to trial, no matter how long that trial took, you got $50. And there were several constraints in the system in the early days. The constraints were that the local property tax dollars paid for everything other than the circuit court judges and the district court judges then, salaries, and also the state paid for the district attorney's salary. Everything else was, the whole system was paid for by county property tax dollars. So there were incredible constraints in the system. There were elaborate plea bargaining systems that were set up statewide, depending upon the types of crimes. We had an incredibly, I'm not trying to judge this, I'm not saying something's good or bad or right or wrong, But if you go back into the system and look at the parole system, it was incredibly different. There were no mandatory minimums. I want to use an example that is almost like trying to kill a fly with a sledgehammer, but it emphasizes where we've come with mandatory minimum sentences. We've come with Measure 11 and the death penalty. Less than a block over here in the mid-70s, Holly Holcomb, superintendent of the Oregon State Police, was killed by one of his former employees. It was a very sensational homicide. The person was convicted of murder. In those days, a person convicted of even killing the superintendent of the Oregon State Police served less than 10 years in the penitentiary. He was out on parole for a couple of years and was subsequently discharged from parole. Life in the old parole system didn't mean life. It meant if you were a good prisoner and convict and didn't cause any ruffles in the system, then you would get out. Today, if a person shoots and kills intentionally a law enforcement officer, whether it's the superintendent of the Oregon State Police or another law enforcement officer, it's aggravated murder. It's a death penalty case. It's life without parole, without the possibility of parole, in fact. So just to kind of highlight, we've come a long ways. The public defender folks, I don't have the energy anymore to do it. Admittedly, 54 years old, but I don't have the energy to go back and do the types of work that needs to be done. But the people that are there work very hard. They do get behind. And the other members of the committee, we have talked to Dave at great length and to try to find a solution to the system. Frankly, folks, I don't know if there is a solution to this system, not from the public defender system. We're the little black tuft of dogs on the dog's tail, and the dog is totally white, and whatever the big dog does, the little tail is gonna flip. And it's important to give sufficient resources to the public defender's office so that they're able to do their job. I know this is not a popular group of folks. I recognize that recent decisions from the Oregon Supreme Court, particularly one in particular, is very difficult even for me to truly want to reconcile with. But I'm more than happy to let the system work, let it go, and I'm very supportive of the public defender budget. I think Robin has done a marvelous job, and Dave in working this out also with the Department of Justice, because they're basically in the same bag that we are. I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Thank you again.
Might I be excused?
Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, following up a little bit on what Mr. Cannon was talking about, one of the most frequently asked questions that I've been asked over the course of my career is, how can you defend those people? How can you do what you do? That would be an easy answer if I were simply to say that in our justice system, somebody has to do it. I've also heard it said that criminal defense lawyers are a necessary evil. My answer goes deeper than that. It has to do with something that I learned many years ago in high school civics. I had a civics instructor that talked about the Bill of Rights and the importance of it. The two points that he made stuck with me. One is, and I think we all know this, it's the Bill of Rights that separates us from the other countries of the world. And secondly, the people who actually make use of the Bill of Rights are generally society's least desirable people. He said that is a concept that you have to get used to if you're going to really be supportive of the Bill of Rights, because a democracy is only as strong as the protection that it provides its least desirable people. We believe very deeply in what we do. Between ourselves and the Attorney General's office, we believe that we accomplish fairness and justice. But we believe that it takes both sides with equal skill and dedication in order to make sure that the system is fair to all people. Appeals, which we do, are our way of making sure that trials that are being provided in the state of Oregon are fair to everyone who's being put on trial, regardless of guilt or innocence at that point. So, are criminal defense lawyers necessary? Yes. Are they evil? Well, not if one, I think, takes the time to understand what it is we do and why. What I'd like to turn to next is to briefly, and hopefully in as interesting a way as possible, take you through the appeals process. What we're going to do is put this on the sideboard, and the idea here is to give you an idea of each step that we take in our office for each appeal, and to give you an idea of how much time it takes the attorney in our office to do each step of the appeal. And I'll try to fill you in on the time frame of the case as it goes through the system as well. As I mentioned before, two kinds of cases that we identify, presumptive merit and presumptive Balfour. The presumptive Balfour cases don't take that long to process, and I'm not going to go through that as part of this presentation. What I am going to do is talk about a presumptive merit case and the steps that we go through to bring that to court. As you can see, the first thing that happens is that we initiate the appeal. What this mostly involves is contacting the trial attorney to find out what portions of the record are important for us to designate. I want to point out here that we do not designate every portion of the record that we could. The standard thing that we would do is say, that we could do, is to say, please give us the entire record, and I believe that would be granted. What we try to do to protect the system somewhat and to not spend as much money as if it's not necessary is we do not designate portions of the record such as the voir dire of the jurors, the opening and the closing statements of counsel, and usually we only designate the portions that the trial attorney tells us is necessary. This saves a great deal on transcript costs, and so it's one step that we take to try and make sure that we're not going overboard. The next step in the process is, and this takes about 3 months overall, we review the record, and that takes approximately 9.5 hours on average. This depends greatly on the size of the transcript that we receive. We receive transcripts of jury trial cases that are anywhere from 100 pages to 8,000 pages. So obviously the amount of time that's taken here is going to vary with the transcript that comes in. This represents an average time per case. Next thing our attorney does is to research potential issues. The important thing to make note of here is that we also have to research issues which are not going to be raised in order to negate them from having to be put into the brief. We don't raise every issue that the trial attorney tells us about. We don't raise every issue that that is potentially in the record. We make a merit determination before we raise the issue, but the research has to be done at this point of the proceedings in order to decide which issues should be raised. The next step, in a rare number of cases, actually about 8.5% of the cases, we file what's called a 138.083 motion. A lot of times a judgment will come to us and it's inaccurate or incorrect. We make a motion in trial court for correction of the record. This does take approximately a half hour of an attorney's time unless the trial judge requests a hearing on it. The next step we come to is the fork in the road. And as Yogi Berra said, when you come to the fork in the road, take it. We take the fork in the road. The first thing we decide is whether the case has merit or lacks merit. If the case has merit, that occurs in 60% of this type of case. And we'll take you through that first. The case has merit. The next thing that we have to do is develop the merit brief. That takes approximately 25 hours. This includes research and writing by the attorney and discussion in team meetings, because we have informal teams that meet and talk about the issues.
Chair?
Yeah. Senator Crowe.
What goes into deciding whether a case has merit? Is when you mean it's not frivolous, do you mean that that there clearly is a side to it that should go ahead for some kind of determination? A case that's not, doesn't have merit, how do you decide it doesn't?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowe, basically an issue, there's a number of things that a trial attorney can raise at trial that are not going to have merit on appeal, and it's based either on the fact that the issue goes against statutory law or goes against well-established Court of Appeals or Supreme Court case law. And if it's occasionally true that we will go ahead and write on an issue that doesn't have merit, but most of the time we instruct the attorneys that if you find an issue in a case that has merit, don't clutter the brief with issues that don't have merit, because that gets confusing to the court. They don't know when you're serious and when you're not. And if you have a good issue, follow that on through, leave the other ones behind. In the cases that don't have any merit at all, have no single meritorious issue, that's something that we're going to get to in the other fork. We've got it set up here so that it goes through.
So you made it some kind of a determination, basically, whether or not the case has merit, and if it does, it's going to go down one path, and if it doesn't, it's going to go down another path.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cho, that's correct, and most attorneys do not make that decision on their own. It's based on discussion with administration or discussion with the trial attorney, fellow attorneys in the office at the team meeting. And so these issues get hashed out and talked about a great deal before that determination is made.
Is there any, as you go through that process, before you get to that stage, do you eliminate anybody's appeal or desire for an appeal before you get there?
Actually, yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, there are a number of people that want to appeal and simply don't have an issue. And to give you an example of that, there are a number of people that wind up pleading guilty and then wish to have an appeal. And if they have received a presumptive sentence or one that's already prescribed by statute, there isn't anything to appeal, and those become the Balfour cases. When Mr. Cannon was in our office and when I started, we had to write a merit brief on those issues. And what we typically did was we concluded that every sentence, no matter how frivolous it seemed to say this, was cruel and unusual punishment. I remember having a case where a person was placed on probation for 3 months, and we had to write a brief, and that person wanted to appeal. So I had to say 3 months of probation was cruel and unusual punishment, which I think pretty much anyone could agree is a frivolous issue. That's what the Balfour case was designed to allow us to take care of. And so there, as I tell my fellow defense attorneys, there are probably 95% of these cases that are clearly frivolous, that we can all agree are frivolous. There's probably 5% that fall into a gray area, which defense attorneys can kind of fight about, depending on how well one knows the case law. And those are the difficult ones for us as well. But
how many cases might you get where someone who has pled guilty and the sentence was pursuant to statute, everything looked correct, who, in reflecting while sitting in the pen or wherever they were, said, you know, I got talked into that by that attorney. I don't think my counsel was very effective. Now, and it can't be that simple for you all to just say, yeah, that attorney was whacked out. We should have, or if I'd been doing that case, we would have pursued on these grounds. How often does that happen?
Well, if I didn't know better, Mr. Chair, I'd accuse you of reading our mail. That's that happens.
Just finished the brethren last night. That happens, I guess.
That happens in literally hundreds of cases a year. What we do in those instances, of course, in Oregon, the structure of the system is such that on direct appeal, ineffective assistance of counsel is not reviewable. So we do not raise that on appeal, and that is left to the process that comes after ours, which is post-conviction relief. And that post-conviction relief is the only stage of proceedings where the court is able, the trial court level to start with, is able to identify whether or not counsel has been effective or not. That's not something our office handles. So our choice, what we do is we write a letter saying, you basically don't have any issues for appeal. What you've complained to us about is a post-conviction matter, and then we include a post-conviction packet and a dismissal form. And if they wish to dismiss their appeal, then they can sign that form and send it back to us. We'll file it for them, and they can proceed into their post-conviction. That's basically the way we do get a great deal of people who take that approach and decide they've been talked into something, but if they've gotten a sentence that's within the the minimum, or within the maximum, then there's nothing we can do for them.
Now that I've been educated as to your role, what do you all reflect on? Do you allow yourself to think about those things, even though you may not be able to render assistance at that point?
About whether
would
council
you have
was
a
affected?
Judgment, yeah, as to how many folks are not asserting rights they should, or?
Mr. Chair, actually, it is a little disturbing to me how many trial attorneys can make mistakes, can make bad strategy decisions, can do things that impact the client. And on review, one doesn't have any way of knowing how much of those choices were the client's. A lot of times we'll take a look at a transcript and say, I don't understand why this attorney did that. It seems like the wrong thing. It's contrary to case law or whatever. And then come, you know, talk to the trial attorney, and the attorney said, that's the way the defendant wanted to handle it. That's what he told me to do. I decided to do that. We didn't have any other strategy, so we'll go through with that. So oftentimes when we think we find something that may be ineffective, it may just be that that's what the client wanted to do. It's really hard for us to tell. But I have had a couple of transcripts in my career where I really did feel that the client had not received adequate representation, and I went ahead and told him, you know, here's a post-conviction packet, you probably should pursue this.
Thank you.
Okay, so then after the merit brief is filed, the next step is we wait probably an equal amount of time to the time that we have a case for the Attorney General to respond. And that can take anywhere. We have a case for as much as I'll get to the time problems in a little bit, but we can have a case for a great deal of time. 300 days is now our limit, so that's close to a year. The Attorney General can have the case for as much as 5 or 6 months before they respond. And that's actually not well represented between those two arrows, or between the two boxes by the blue arrow. When we get the respondent's brief from the Attorney General, often, well, 5.67% of the cases we file a reply to that brief. So it's clearly not very long, very many cases that we do that in. The next step that comes along is once all the briefing is done, oral argument is set in the Court of Appeals. If we're going to orally argue a case and we don't argue all of them, we make it another judgment decision based on collective wisdom, I suppose you'd say, as to whether or not the case will be argued. If we argue it, then it takes about 13 hours of prep time. That again includes meetings with the team to determine whether the issue, what to say, a mock argument, if you will, kind of a practice argument. In the cases that we don't argue, they're merely set on the Court of Appeals docket and they're submitted on brief. So those don't involve that segment of time. Assuming we lose, the next step in the process is a petition for review to the Oregon Supreme Court. The Oregon Supreme Court does not have to seek review in a case, or not have to grant review in a case. They do it very rarely. So in order for us to prevail at this stage, we have to write a petition for review that they think is interesting and something they want to review. As you see from the next panel, review is denied in 94% of our cases. In 6% of our cases, the Supreme Court will grant review or allow review. If review is denied, we will have spent a total of 62 hours on a case that we will have argued in the Court of Appeals. So that's approximately a week and a half of time exclusively devoted to that single case. With client communication, an additional 2 hours almost in every case, the grand total works out to be 63 and a half hours. We will explain to the client what happened in the appellate courts and what his or her next step is, much the way we just discussed, and send them a packet of post-conviction materials. If a review is allowed, then we go on to the next track.
Can I go back on it?
Yes,
David?
Mr. Chair.
You turn down 94% of the time.
That's correct.
I guess a lot of those instances, are you required to seek further review by statute, or do you have some judgment in these to say, look, chances are pretty slim that the Supremes are going to take this on, so why do we go through the effort?
Mr. Chair, in all of the Balfour cases that we don't write a brief that has an argument in it, in all of those cases we feel we have the discretion not to seek review, or not to, if it's a case that we wrote a brief on, an actual merit brief, then there's a federal case from some years ago that requires us to write a petition for review to exhaust that person's state remedies before they can go federal. So if a person's going to file a federal habeas later, they have to have exhausted all their state remedies or the federal court will throw them out. So we think that we pretty much have to do that, even if the issue lacks merit. And this is...
Do you spend a lot of time developing that kind of brief, or is it just kind of going through the motions so that you've exhausted the remedy?
Mr. Chair, it's pretty much going through the motions, and the 5-point, what did we have there, 5.3 hours that we take to do a petition for review reflects an average. In the cases that are of high merit, it'll be upwards of 10 or 15 hours, but in a large number of our cases that you just identified, those are very short, quick petitions for review. We know, and I think the court knows, that they are done to exhaust the inmate's remedy.
Thank you.
Can the inmate stop this process at any stage of the game if he wants, just changes his mind about the appeal?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, yes. At any point in time, they can decide they no longer wish to appeal. And if they contact us, then we file a motion to dismiss whatever stage they're at.
But most of them want to go through all of the stage stuff.
Senator Trow, yes. The majority of them wish to go through this process. I think that sometimes the ones that are not as knowledgeable wind up talking to inmate paralegals, and the paralegals will tell them. The paralegals deal a great deal more with the federal remedy than we do. And so they're actually probably more apt to be the ones to tell them, in order to exhaust your state remedy, you have to go through this process, and then we can look at the federal remedy.
So there's another state, there's another process after this, once this is exhausted.
Correct.
Are you involved then in defending them at the federal level, or does somebody else do that?
Senator Trow, no, there's a federal defender that's set up in every state, and there's a very effective federal defender for the state of Oregon. It's run by Steve Wax, Portland.
Must he accept every case that they want to send up to him?
I believe that they look into every case, and I do not believe they accept every case. I think that they have as many as 70 or 80 petitions for habeas corpus, which is that stage in any one year, which is not a large number. But I think they decide not to do work on a large number of those cases. Okay, then, the next step we go through when review is allowed is the brief on the merits. This is a brief that is supposed to contain all of the policy and all of the arguments that can be made at this level. It takes a great deal of time. As you can see, we average 61 and a half hours on this. The point here is that you get into kind of things that we used to really get into in law school, like ALR articles, policy reviews, and sort of a nationwide search as to what the law is in all of the states on this particular issue. So it involves a great deal of time, and a person gets to be quite an expert in that area. Then the next step we get to after the state has responded to our brief on the merits is oral argument. Again, it takes longer to prepare in the Supreme Court because there's more time involved in actually speaking. They give us a half hour. The Court of Appeals only gives us 15 minutes. They get pretty deep into it. I mean, these are folks that really want to know which way the law should go. And I'll have to agree with Mr. Cannon's assessment. I think they take their jobs very, very seriously and want to do the best they can for the state and for the individual, and to make sure the law is accurate. We do the same thing, so it takes very nearly 20 hours of practice arguments to get ready for this. So that works out to a grand total at that stage of 143 hours, again with client communication, We come to a grand total of 144 hours and a half on a case that makes it from the very beginning all the way through the Supreme Court argument. It's a minority of our cases, but it does take a lot of time when we get to that stage. And of course, these are the ones that our people love to work on. These are the ones that engage you and are the kind that that you really like to do. It's the cases where there aren't any issues that kind of get in the way and slow us down.
Incorporated in that time, David, are all of the attorney hours, and when you have the group meetings, I assume everybody is getting some credit for participation in that.
Mr. Chair, actually, I'm not sure that we do figure the other group hours into that 144. I believe that figure,
if I'm correct,
is just the single attorney.
Right.
So the contribution you might make sitting in is not recorded.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. That would we haven't included that in there yet.
Thank you.
Now, how many of these are there a year that really go all the way through to the Supreme Court?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, of course, we have the death penalty branch, which is approximately 5 cases a year, and those are automatic review, and we have 3 attorneys which do nothing but that. But in these kinds of cases, we probably have 10 to 15 cases a year that go this route, that all the way through the Supreme Court. Going back to the original fork in the road, where we were identifying cases that have merit, about 40% of cases that we assume are going to have merit to start with don't have any. After we've reviewed the record, we can't find any issues to raise. I'll have attorneys coming into my office several times a day for what we call a Balfour review, and that will be to determine whether or not another person in the office thinks there's any issue in the case. If we determine there is no issue, then we send a Balfour packet to the client. What this involves is we have to prepare a skeleton brief that's just got the procedural history of the case. It makes no argument on behalf of the individual. It simply contains a conclusion saying that we have sent this material to the individual to allow them to raise any issue they want to raise. If we get back from them any kind of argument at all, and these can be kind of illegible, hand-scrawled things that come from the penitentiary, then we type those up and we call those a Part B to the Part A that we file. And so that whole brief then is submitted to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals is required to determine the outcome of the case based on our skeleton brief and the client's Part B. Oftentimes, we will receive this back as having been undeliverable, in which case we determine that we've lost contact with our client and we move to withdraw. The case will then go into default and be dismissed by the Court of Appeals. Other times, we will not hear from the client, but we will assume, since we didn't hear from them and we know where they are, that they wanted to go ahead with the Balfour Part B or Part A of the brief. So we will submit simply the part that we prepared, and it will go into the Court of Appeals. The Attorney General does not respond to these. It takes none of their time, and the case then is affirmed by the Court of Appeals. I'm not aware of any case that's ever been reversed by the Court of Appeals or taken any action by the Court of Appeals that's a Balfour type case. Nonetheless, the total for this type of case in a presumptive merit case is still almost 23 hours, which with client communication leads to a grand total of 24 and a half hours. This again is a presumptive merit case. In the presumptive Balfour cases, the grand total is a lot less than that because there's just not that much record to review. But the average in a presumptive merit case is almost 25 hours. I appreciate you bearing with me on all that because that is the process that we go through in our cases for our presumptive merit, and I think it's kind of important to understand the time that we take. It's helpful when we say that we have 4 cases that we assign presumptive merit cases per attorney per month. It's a little bit hard to understand how such a small number could take so much time unless you go through the process step by step and see it. Any further questions on the appeal process itself? What I'd like to do next is talk briefly about a little bit of pertinent history. And this is not on the board. I think this is just me. In 1991, there was the system worked a little bit differently. We were taking appeals, and I was not the director of the office then, but we were taking appeals, but a vast number of the cases that we were assigned or that we were referred were not being done by our office. They were being referred out of the office through a process that we informally called reversion. We were reverting the cases back to the state court administrator. And this was done because we did not have sufficient attorneys in the office to process the cases that were being referred to us. In 1991, an agreement was struck by which we agreed to take nearly all of the appeals back, less the actual conflicts of interest, in return for which, at the time, we were actually trying to do post-conviction and state habeas cases, and we're not having much success getting them all done, so we transferred those back to the state court administrator. And since 1991, that's been the system. The first two biennia, that worked pretty well, and we did not start working, we did not have a backlog, we were doing well, I think, in terms of getting the cases out. 1995, of course, was ballot measure 11. Ballot measure 11 changed the landscape for appeals for much the same reason Mr. Cannon was talking about, which is that people stayed in prison longer. When people stay in prison longer, they have a tendency to think more about what they can do to get out of prison. A lot of times that involves the legal process, and they're going to examine and explore their appeals much more frequently and much more vigorously than they would have perhaps otherwise. We figured that because of ballot measure 11, our flat number of cases went up about 390 per year. That's not all merit briefs, that's just the number of cases that went up, because people still did wind up pleading guilty, and we still did have, for a while we were challenging ballot measure 11 in every case, but that's died out now. Ballot measure 11's been upheld, and we don't typically try to challenge it in our briefs anymore. The complexity of the caseload increased at that point because more people were asking for jury trials at the trial level than pleading guilty, and so the number of complex appeals went up at that time. In 1999, our staff was increased. What we had at that point was we had three death penalty attorneys who were also trying to do a two-thirds to three-quarters sized Court of Appeals caseload. That was totally unworkable for them. So we asked the legislature, and the legislature granted in 1999 three new attorneys to take those caseloads away from the death penalty attorneys so that they could do nothing but death penalty. We were very grateful for that. That didn't have a great impact on our backlog because the backlog had been starting to grow because of the 1995 ballot measure 11, and we were starting to get behind. These three attorneys didn't have that big an impact on that. And as a result, we had to go to the emergency board a number of times. Our history with the emergency board began on October 8, 1999, for which we received a $5,000 supplemental appropriation, and as Ms. Lamont pointed out, required to obtain the services of a management consultant to develop an overview of our system to see whether we were functioning and whether we were functioning adequately and whether we could do better. Before I introduce the management consultant, I just want to complete very quickly our history with the emergency board. On December 10th, 1999, we went before the board to ask for a federal funds grant application. The legislature granted our request to do that, but the federal government denied our grant. On February 22nd, 2000, we requested $101,800 for the purpose of finding contract attorneys with whom we could contract to take our backlog, to begin reducing our backlog, and that was granted. April 28, 2000, we asked for an additional $74,600 for the same purpose of continuing to contract with attorneys to reduce our backlog, and that was granted. And then in November of 2000, we made a progress report, and as Ms. Lamont pointed out, we reported that we had reduced our backlog by 42%, so that whole process was successful. And what I'd like to do now is have Mr. Guilfoy, our consultant, come up and talk about the process from his point of view.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Guilfoy. I'm a management consultant with Aldridge Kilbride in Tatone. As Dave Groom has pointed out to you, I was hired by the department really to work on two issues. The first issue surrounded the public defender and its budget, and what really kind of spawned that concern was that the public defender had exceeded its 1997-99 budget by about $5,000. It really raised the question about budgetary controls and accounting controls and some of those issues in the public defender's office. And so I looked at those and worked with the public defender to strengthen those areas. The second area concerned the backlog, and a concern that there was a growing backlog of cases in the public defender's office, and were there ways that the public defender could more efficiently and effectively process cases, and we worked on those as well. I've given you a report, and I won't spend time going into the report in a great deal of detail other than to just summarize, because I know you are going to also try to get to work session today if you can. We established five outcomes, and when I speak of we, I'm talking about the legislative fiscal analyst, the budget analyst, and the public defender staff, and I established about five outcomes that we needed to achieve as part of this project. The first three of those related to the issues of budget and accountability and being able to have systems in place to make sure that the public defender was spending its money appropriately and had adequate spending controls. And you'll see in those outcomes, we looked at basically the office manager's position to see if we had both the right person in that job and also what it really took to do that job effectively. Through that process, the public defender and I had a series of meetings with the Department of Administrative Services, with the office manager. We looked at the processes that were in place, and we found that basically there were two systems that were there. One was the automated system, and the other was the manual system for keeping books. And part of this was because the office manager did not have enough background in how to use those systems, the automated systems, effectively, nor did she have an extensive background in using PCs and some of the spreadsheet technology that's out there. And as a result of that, the public defender never really knew for sure exactly where the budget stood. Through that process, we did develop a work plan for the office manager. The office manager subsequently resigned in February, and the public defender was very fortunate to find Angelique Bowers, who is sitting behind us, a very experienced person who has a great deal of expertise in all of the state's systems and also in using spreadsheet technologies and so forth. Working together, we've developed spending controls, authorization processes, budget status reports. The public defender and the chief deputy public defender, Jess Barton, are both actively involved in budget management now, and we don't believe that you'll see those problems again. I think they're able to, with some pretty good precision, forecast their budget pretty closely now. The second outcome and the third outcome dealt with the Department of Administrative Services, and again, with the addition of the office manager, we were able to...
Excuse me, Senator Crowe has a question. Yeah.
As they, they keep up with their budget and they realize suddenly that, by golly, there's just not enough money here to meet our needs. Even if you realize that, what do you do about it?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tro, the issue before was that they ended up just overspending their budget without actually realizing it. Now at least they can forecast ahead of time. This is a dilemma that the public defender does have, and I think they've picked up and kicked over about every tin can that they have over there to try to find ways to save money, and they're actually down to being very, very close, within just thousands of dollars of spending their entire budget this time, including the emergency fund allocations. But I think it's real important for them now to have this capacity to project so they can come in to see you ahead of time before they actually overspend the budget, and I believe that they can do that. It hasn't solved the financial problem, though, as you point out. Mr. Chair and members, the second and the third outcomes really dealt with the roles and responsibilities between the Department of Administrative Services, who provide some accounting support and budget support and the public defender. And again, with the addition of the office manager, we have somebody who understands how to use these systems and is working very, very effectively. So I don't anticipate in those first three outcomes that you're going to see any of those issues surface again. I'd like to spend a little bit more time on the fourth and the fifth outcomes, which concerned how cases were are being processed in the public defender's office and also workloads and performance measures for staff. The public defender has reported to the emergency board on its progress, and so I'll just summarize that. But basically, we took a look at how cases come into the system. Dave Broom has shown you how that process works. And by looking at that and working with the two deputy public defenders, we established within public defender a new organization structure where cases are now assigned based on whether they're easy cases, whether they're felony ones, felony twos, or death penalty cases. And this has allowed the public defender to more appropriately align the assignment of cases with the capability of the attorney staff that are there. So they're more experienced attorneys get the more difficult types of cases. And by allocating the work that way, they've also been able to establish standards for each of those levels, a certain number of cases per month to be processed by each of those groups. And that caseload and those caseload standards have now been approved by the Public Defender Committee and are the basis by which the state public defender does measure performance and holds attorneys accountable for producing. Although the backlog of cases still does persist, the public defender is now able to monitor that much, much better. Also, the public defender did hire a computer consultant who has helped the public defender automate what were manual tracking systems, just basically hand annotations of where cases were and what the statuses of cases are. And now the public defender is able to go into a database and at any one particular time pull out where cases are by attorneys and what production has been. And these tools have allowed the public defender to manage the workload of the staff much more effectively. The public defender also is using these management tools and has taken corrective action on some attorney with some attorney performance problems. One attorney was demoted, another attorney has been dismissed for non-performance. And so, again, I believe that they've made significant progress in this area. But with all of that work that has been done, the backlog does continue to persist, and Dave is going to talk to you a little bit more about that. I believe, having been with this process for about 15 months now with a public defender, that there still is a resource issue over there. I don't believe anybody is sitting on their hands. People are working very, very hard. It's a very dedicated staff. The caseload standards that are set right now really don't take into account training of new attorneys coming in. They don't take into account the fact that people get sick or that they take vacations and some of those things. And so the staff really should be commended for what they've been able to do. They've had a significant reduction in the backlog of cases, but yet again, they're still going to need your continued support. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and then if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your report. Are there questions?
Chair.
Representative Leonard.
Representative Doyle and I could benefit by having Mr. Guilfoy help us with some negotiations we're involved in with the state police. This is the kind of thing we were. I mean, I really appreciate this kind of work and the things that you've done. I know how hard it is to accomplish these things in a state agency, and again, we've tried with others. And, kind of success, so I want to commend you for your good work.
Thank you very much, Representative Leonard. I appreciate that.
All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll be as brief as I can be here talking about the last couple of things. First thing I wanted to talk about is that we were directed by the last legislature to assist the system in finding ways to help reduce appeals. We participated in interim judiciary committee meetings, and that project resulted in two bills which have made their way through the House, I think, at this point, and are into the Senate. The first one is House Bill 2348. That has to do with parole appeals. That, without getting into too much detail, parole appeals had been being raised by state habeas corpus and being raised through the Indigent Defense Branch of the State Court Administrator's Office. That was not proving to be very cost effective. These are administrative appeals, so 2348 would transfer that responsibility back to the State Public Defender's Office to appeal those, and we have attempted to cooperate as much as possible. And we're not thrilled by taking more parole appeals back because they're not very interesting. But that being said, we are trying to assist with that process, and that again, I'm thinking that is in the Ways and Means now. The other one is House Bill 2351, which I think is all the way through the House. 2351 is interesting because it does remove the automatic right to appeal in guilty plea, probation violation, and no contest cases, the cases that we call the presumptive Balfour cases. It allows the filing of a notice of appeal in those cases only if there is a colorable claim of error. So what would happen is we'd get a call from a trial attorney saying, I have an appeal for you. We would find out whether there was any issue raised by that trial attorney or any issue raised by the sentencing, and if not, then we would not file a notice of appeal, and that case would go directly into post-conviction. That could have the effect of removing 300 or 400 cases per year from our system, and I think it would be a very good thing for everyone. And I believe the clients would not go without representation at this point because they're most of those folks really only have a post-conviction claim having to do with the ineffectiveness of their counsel or the voluntariness of their plea. And so I don't believe that we would be sacrificing any individual rights in that situation.
Senator Trow.
Should both of these pass, would the fact that you picked up some additional clientele in the first one be manageable because you would lose some responsibility in the second one?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, the 2348 does have a fiscal impact, and we have estimated that it will take one more attorney and half of a secretary position to accomplish that. These parole cases are, we hope, tapering off because actually parole is no longer a system. It's post-prison supervision now. The people that are on parole or going to be on parole are people that have been in it for a very long time, and we think that system's kind of going to be dropping off as the years go by. That's, I think, probably everybody's hope on that.
Would the second one reduce what you do significantly or not?
Senator Trow, it would reduce the number of cases that we do significantly. Time-wise, it would have a minimal impact.
You're going to need some help if you have to do the first one, clearly.
Finally, what I want to do is talk about the problems that we have and short and long-term solutions that we think can work. First of all, as Mr. Guilfoy indicated, the goal that we identified in our budget of reducing all of our backlog by June 1st, 2001, or July 1st, 2001, reducing all of our backlog and then reducing it further to 210 days by July 1st, 2003 is not going to be possible. We put that in our budget last year before we knew the dollar problems that the state was going to get into. And obviously there's a problem now, and we're going to have a difficult time reducing our backlog any further at the present time. The Court of Appeals, the legislature helped us a great deal in reducing our backlog, and our backlog at that time we were measuring it by 400 days from the date that the transcript is filed in our office to the date that the appeal brief is due. 400 days is a great deal of time for a person to sit and wait for their appeal, and we were very cognizant of that, and we were in support of reducing that as much as we could. Unfortunately, given the level of the volume of the cases, we were not able to reduce that, and the legislature assisted us by allowing some of those cases to be transferred to people we contracted with who could do them right away. About the time we got that caseload pretty much under control and reduced the 400-day cases to zero was the time that the Court of Appeals reduced the 400-day limit to 300 days. So that means we now have 300 days from the date the transcript is in our office to the date that the brief is due. And that had the impact of having our backlog go back up to about where it was. In light of the state's budget difficulties, I went to the Court of Appeals last week and asked the chief judge if there was any leeway in this, and she indicated that there was, that there's going to be some leniency in granting motions for extension of time, and that we should be able, and I asked her to do that at least for the rest of this biennium, and she agreed with that and is going to write us a letter to that effect. In the meantime, the second short-term solution, we're beginning discussions with the State Court Administrator's Office, the Indigent Defense Branch, to try and, as Ms. Lamont indicated, try and find ways within existing budgets to transfer some of our overload cases to attorneys that she employs on a contract basis to see if we can't reduce our backlog at no further cost to the system. We've only just begun talking about that particular short-term solution, and I'm confident that we'll be able to find some ways to do that. If we are not able to do that, then there's going to be a bit of a problem, and this would lead to our longer-term solution, which once again, I'm understanding the budget problems you have, but the longer-term solution would be a legislatively funded overflow panel of attorneys. We identified that in our original policy package 105. Policy package 105 would allow us. It's actually a special purpose appropriation. It's not something we're asking for to be put into our budget. It's simply an amount set aside for the emergency board, so that if we run into problems with our backlog, that we could go to the emergency board, ask for a specific amount of money for contracting purposes, and then allow us to contract out our backlog to the degree possible. So that is the longer-term solution. An even longer-term solution, in my opinion, is the Public Defense Services Commission, which is going to be heard by the Senate Judiciary in early April. That's something that we've been working on during the interim, and a number of very creative people have been involved in that process, and I'm very hopeful that continues. If the Public Defender Services Commission were to pass and to become law, my little office would be out of your hair. We would not be coming to you with our budgetary problems or with our caseload problems. We would be able to go to the Public Defense Services Director and say, here's our problem, and we can transfer around cases and funds within that agency. That's my opinion.
Senator Trump. Where does that agency get its funds?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, at this point, that's a problem. There isn't any funding that I know of right now that's about to take place. I guess our best hope is that the bill that would continue the currently existing Public Defense Commission, which is sort of a study group, would continue for another 2 years, and that we could at least keep that idea alive. Just to conclude, we have asked for some special language that Ms. Lamont has put in her report, would include restoration of the governor's 2.4% service level and funding of policy package 105, which I just talked about. In addition to that, we're asking for some language to be included in the budget report about salary equalization. Present time, the members of the Appellate Division of the Attorney General's Office, which do identical work to us, almost identical, are paid approximately 10 to 30% more, depending on the position, than our staff is. We think it's a matter of fairness that at some point the legislature attempt to address this. Once again, money isn't there, but If that language could be included, then it would at least continue us with the possibility of asking for that should the May forecast prove to be a little rosier than everybody seems to think it will be. Mr. Chair, that concludes my presentation. If the panel has any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Thank you, David. Are there questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, we will in the public hearing on Senate Bill 5540, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 5540. Robin.
Mr. Chair, members, just briefly, I did not include any language at this point talking about salary parity or the funding for a overload panel. Part of my thinking is that we are going to have, I assume we are going to have that Public Defense Services Commission bill in front of us at some point in time. And if you recall, there are system-wide issues for trial and appellate attorney parity and those kinds of things. I felt that that was a discussion we should probably have when we have the system bill in front of us. So that I just wanted to explain my rationale for not including that in the recommendations in this budget. It is not that that I'm not aware of the fact that these are significant issues.
Very good.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Trowell.
What's the likelihood of that bill getting to us? Is it already through a substantive committee and in Ways and Means hands or not?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Trowell, it is not in Ways and Means yet. I don't believe it's even had a public hearing yet.
Does it seem likely that that will be favorably received in a Judiciary Committee and sent to Ways and Means? Anybody know? I mean, if we're going to wait,
I don't know, but
need to know the likelihood.
Yeah.
Robin, you think so?
I believe so. I get it. Mr. Chair, Senator Trowell, I can't predict what the Substantive Committee is going to do, but
you
yes.
never can.
but I believe so.
You know, it's not unlikely that they might what hear it and then ship it to us for
in case it doesn't, is there any alternative to this budget decision that we'll be making now?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trowell, certainly we could entertain motions to add some additional language. In terms of the dollar amounts in this budget, the answer is not at this time.
All right, now Robin, you want to go through your numbered
sure.
recommendations, please?
Let me ask you what your preference is. Procedurally, would you like to have motions on each of these, or would you like to wait?
I think we can do one.
Okay, wait till we get to number seven.
Unless
and do seven and eight.
If some member leaps out of their chair after you've made the description, then
okay.
pause.
My first recommendation, this is on page 2 of my memo, is to approve the adjusted current service level of 5882431 and 41 FTE. That includes the standard PERS, Secretary of State, and other reductions. It's also adjusted. LFO made an adjustment in the budget to remove $11,000 in one-time funding from the Emergency Board for training and computers programming funds. Approve the governor's, this is item 2, approve the governor's current service level reduction of 2.4%, which is
$141,785.
Probably safe.
You okay?
We're not?
Okay.
I'll
just be right in the hall.
With you?
Don't go far.
What has he done?
Maybe I can come in and vote for him. Down the line a little bit.
Approve policy option package 107. This was requested by the public defender. It eliminates one clerical position and reallocates $64,996 from personal services to services and supplies. Approve the LFO adjustments on page 3 of your spreadsheet. This action eliminates one unfunded FTE in the governor's budget and reduces 1.3 clerical support positions based on the reduction in the governor's budget. Approve the recommended agency budget of 5740646 general fund and 39 positions, which is 38.7 FTE, which is page 3 on your worksheet. Approve the following statements in the budget report. It is the priority of the subcommittee to restore the governor's current service level budget reduction of 141785 general fund and 1.3 FTE, one position. And the subcommittee encourages the Public Defender to continue collaborative efforts with the Judicial Department Indigent Defense Services Division to address the appellate case backlog within existing resources. And with those recommendations, I would recommend that the subcommittee amend Senate Bill 5540, Section 1, to delete 5765923 and insert 5740646.
Senator Representative Leonard has moved that we adopt the LFO recommendations, just recited points 1 through 7 on the memorandum.
Mr. Chair.
Is there discussion, Senator Crowe?
I'll give you a courtesy vote because I know that you can get another vote if you need it on this budget. But I really do think that I don't see anything here helping them deal with their backlog. And they did have some proposals in their budget that would have done that. So my guess is that if they have to live with this budget, their backlog will continue to grow and it will be a problem. Now, maybe the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals can give them some excuse for just delaying cases for a long time, but even so, I think at some point we got a problem here. And so that's why I would give a courtesy yes, but I'd like to point out that we need to do more for this agency. We ask them to do a lot and we don't adequately support them.
I think we can just make a copy of that speech and insert a different agency about every 3 days.
Probably, yeah.
And we'll wait that May forecast and fill them all back up.
Well, I wish I had confidence in the May forecast.
There further discussion. Representative Leonard, your motion.
I would just say I appreciate the language that says, and I'm trying to find it. I'm here to find it, that the subcommittee.
Item six.
Yeah, it is a priority of the subcommittee to restore the governor's current service level budget reduction of 141. I appreciate having that in there because then that means to me it is important enough that when we get our May forecast, this will be one of those that we will have on the short list to restore funds to. So.
Chair, even with that, though, we spent a lot of time looking at the problems of the backlog, and they do have some suggestions as to how to get at it in this budget, and I guess we're just not able to do that. I'm sorry we're not able to take their suggestions and help them with a problem that they've studied and identified and are trying to deal with.
Further discussion on the motion? Is there objection to the motion?
Courtesy,
hearing,
yes.
Seeing none, it is with courtesy. Yeah, adopted. Now, Representative Leonard moves Senate Bill 5540 as amended to the full Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Is there courtesy? Hearing and seeing some of that, it is approved. And carriers for the carrying the house?
Sure.
Why, thank you. And you want me to do that since you're uneasy?
And I'll comment on it.
Don't comment on the quality of my presentation,
no, I won't.
Just
I
the
won't.
Budget.
Right. That's right.
Thank you. Is there anything further to come before the subcommittee?
Just briefly, Larry handed out the agenda for the remainder of the week. We did have the public defender on the agenda tentatively if needed, so I believe that means that you have a day off tomorrow.
That works out perfect for me.
Oh. Well, we'll try to fill it up then if that made it good for you. We'll have some kind of informational gathering of some kind. What attendance required.
That's the day the chair buys the donuts, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Nothing further to come before the subcommittee. We are adjourned.
You want some of us to